From Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning. Focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio.
It's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful day the Lord has made as we move on into the month of July and into the heat of our summer. We're pleased and honored to welcome in Ned DeLessie, the retired former executive director of the California Catholic Conference, which represented all the bishops of California. Ned, a good day to you.
Good day. Good to be with you again, Bob, and with the listeners also.
It's been much too long.
Thank you for the call.
Yeah, Ned was a regular on this program. How long were you with the conference, Ned?
22 years.
Wow. And you were also with the conference up in Washington State?
I was up there for 10 years, yes.
Wow. You're a seasoned veteran.
Yes. And, before that, I was working for the Archdiocese of Seattle. So, I've been a professional church employee for most of my life.
So when you were with the Washington Conference, was that in Olympia or was that in Seattle?
Well, the offices were in Seattle, but we commuted to Olympia because it was a part-time legislature, one year and 4 months the other year.
So. Mm-hmm. Is it still that way in Washington?
It is.
Wow. How do they get away with that? California has just made it into occupation.
California has a full-time legislature. They have a part-time legislature there, and they have a four-month session every other year to pass a budget. Unlike California, they have a two-year budget instead of a one-year budget. And so, quite civilized and quite humane, and different times, of course. 20-plus years ago, different times and different politics. But it's a challenge for the members here in California because you're trying to stay connected to your constituency, back and be part of the communities that you represent, et cetera. But you spend a significant amount of time in Sacramento, so there's a lot of commuting back and forth. Whereas in a state like Washington, it was you live with your community and you're there, and there are committee meetings that happen throughout the rest of the year in different parts of the state, and then you pack it up and head to Olympia.
I remember Olympia, Tumwater.
Tumwater, Olympia beer.
The beer, yes. I don't think they make it any there. They still make it, but I don't think they make it there.
That is correct.
Yeah. Yeah, even though it was the best water in the world.
Yes, it definitely was the best water in the world. Well, and you've been staying well, I hope.
I have. You and your family as well, I hope.
Yeah, definitely. My wife Colleen says it's hard to have a pity party when our biggest struggles are not being able to see the grandkids and not being able to go out with friends. And, other people struggle and suffer more mightily than some people in our more retired circumstance.
Well, I tell the kids, I say, you're lucky we have a backyard, We have a backyard and there's a trampoline in it and you can run around and play they've handled it well, but you're right. We're very fortunate, many of us, that, we have our health and can get out in the sunshine a little bit
And stories from around the world, from people I know work for the church in other parts of the world where poverty is endemic and their struggle and their inability to provide hospitalization and sometimes basic necessities,
I can't even imagine the difficulties we're having stamping this thing out. And then I start thinking about some of these other countries and I can't imagine how difficult it must be there.
Yeah. Very challenging, very challenging. But let's not dwell too much on that.
Yeah, indeed. Well, my mom told me when she retired, she was never so busy as when she retired. And I presume that's true for you, too.
You get busy with the things that, that you have a passion and a heart for that don't cause you a lot of stress and anxiety. So I have the opportunity to still sponsor what the Catholic Church calls a canonical sponsor for Catholic health care for Providence St. Joseph Health, and that takes up a significant amount of time to keep our Catholic health care healthy, holy, and healing. And And then some other volunteer things, working on the Caring for the Whole Person initiative to transform how our parishioners and others experience the end of life. And so mm-hmm. I'm working on setting up some workshops for priests and deacons on that. And so that's a passion of mine. And the occasional other thing, you know, on the parish council at my parish, things like that. So, yeah, a lot of fun.
Very good. Very good. And you also have been involved in some freedom of religion issues.
Yes, that was doing that. As the last couple of years, I was working at the conference that Bishop Soto had invited me to represent him in particular in terms of how we engaged with the other faith communities here, primarily the evangelical community and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints around religious liberty. And, you know, John Watkins and some others are formally representing the bishop, but I stay involved in that effort too.
And how is that going? We just had a Supreme Court decision that was very interesting,
mm-hmm.
out of Montana.
Yes, yeah, that was it was interesting. I would say, given the nature of the court, not unexpected.
Right.
The fact that if the state chooses to, provide scholarship funding for, if they choose to provide scholarship funding for, for private schools, it would be discriminatory not to do it for religious schools. So, and I think that was pretty self-evident. I think it's a quality and positive ruling because many states would like to offer those options and opportunities for parental choice and we obviously have an oar in that water, but I think the other challenge is in some states, they will use that as an excuse not to offer any
right at all
assistance to any private schools. So, the beat goes on, but yes, it was a positive decision.
Yeah, I was not surprised either, and have argued similar cases with my friends. Dealing with this, that it's not the state should always kind of slap religion in the face. The state should just treat religion on equal footing with anything else. And this seems to be that sort of case where it turns out the state of Montana, was offering aid to private schools or the parents of, private school children, however it worked. And specifically excluded, the Montana Supreme Court specifically said, no, you can't do this because it's going to religious schools as well. And that got appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I would hope that things like that are a 9-0 decision. That one looked like a slam dunk to me.
Yeah, I was hoping it'd be 9-0 also, but, it was the right decision. I think the underlying reality is Montana, similar to California and Washington and many of the western states, has what's called the Blaine Amendment in the late 1800s. And that states agreed with the federal government as part of their statehood, et cetera, or whatever arrangements they were negotiating at the time, that they would not provide aid to religious schools. And to have that struck down would be what needs to happen. I'm not sure that this ruling goes that far, but I think it's a step in the right direction.
Well, I think it was the Hosanna Tabor case was, I think that was 9-0, and that wasn't that long ago. And there were probably a couple of justices ago, but it was still 9-0.
Yeah.
And then I remember another one. I can't remember the name of the case itself, but it had to do with paving playgrounds.
Yes, I forgive me, but I can't remember the name of that one. The Hosanna Tabor was 2012. And
wow, was it that long ago?
Lutheran schools.
Lutheran schools, right.
And was it 9-0 and is defined, or at least granted what is called the ministerial exemption.
Right.
And that's going to be under some interesting challenges coming forward as we move forward. The other case that you reference, I can't also remember exactly when and what the decision was, but it did have to do with the fact that the state can't give aid to private schools to fix their playgrounds and then say they're not going to give it to a religious school.
Right, but exactly.
That would not be acceptable.
I remember one of the justices, it may have been John Roberts, who said, this is not about teaching the kids the catechism. This is about preventing skinned knees.
Correct.
I think that logic won the day.
Yeah, common sense.
Common sense.
It would. But you know, there are many interesting challenges ahead as we look at the religious liberty front, particularly as we get ready to celebrate the 4th of July. But one of the fundamental freedoms of the United States, which has been an interesting debate for us as Catholics, because we tend to the society has tended to view that that as a private thing, but as Catholics we have a very public theology and a very public engagement, and so we tend to view the freedom of religion as more of a public and a private issue,
right.
And that's where we're going to run into some challenges moving forward, because the society at the moment is fixated on individual rights rather than collective rights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it doesn't necessarily fit into the legal argument, but a society that allows a robust freedom of religion is going to be a better society.
By all means, and one can get into some minor debates about the intentions of the founding fathers,
right?
But they were certainly faith-filled, at least deists in the case of Thomas Jefferson. But many of the others were faith-filled, and they viewed that the state should not be dictating to religion how they behave and what they do, and at the same time, the state should not adopt one religion. And and that's the basis of our religious freedom clause at the moment is, the free exercise, and that we have an opportunity not to have the state impose.
They always talk about the intent of the founders, and especially when it comes to court issues. And it was a few years ago where we had 3 Jewish members and 6 Catholics on the Supreme Court. And I thought, I wonder what the founders would have thought about that.
Yeah, well, and then, as I think you've seen in some of the articles, the fact that currently, 5 of the members of the Supreme Court went to Catholic school.
Right, right.
although a number of them voted against the decision we were just referencing.
Indeed, they did, yes.
In the Montana case, but, it's an interesting time, an interesting moment, and I think the opportunities that, that are before us are challenging, to say the least. The recent case on the Louisiana abortion case was, interesting from the standpoint of legal, but also interesting from the standpoint of the political.
Right.
The larger pro-life concerns that we share, and I think to read intelligent commentators like Professor Helen Alvarez, and some of the others that are engaged in it, would say that it's not a setback in any way, shape, or form. It's much more of a technical ruling, while disappointing. We should not be alarmed, but look for better sets of facts.
Yes, it's interesting. Obviously, it's sometimes almost amusing. Other than the topic is serious, is they describe somebody as the swing vote. Well, in a 5-4, any of the 5 could have been the swing vote because their votes all count equally. But they tend to. They used to give Anthony Kennedy was the swing vote, and now it's John Roberts, and Roberts, with his ruling on so-called Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, where, and as we've always noted, we're not liberal or conservative or Democrat or Republican, we're Catholic, and there were parts of the Affordable Care Act that dealing with abortion, et cetera, that we were very opposed to, but generally Catholics are in favor of universal health care, et cetera. But in that ruling, you know, everybody thought, oh, this is going to be 5-4 to overturn, you know, the Affordable Care Act. And Roberts came up with a kind of a theory that even the majority opinion didn't go along with, but he voted with the majority that it was basically a tax in the Congress. And my sense from a lot of that is he's hesitant to overturn congressional action unless he can find something really egregious about it.
That's correct, and he tends to reflect on precedent to a certain degree. But,
exactly.
Certainly doesn't necessarily take the more intention of the authors as strictly as some of the other members do. So, you know, it's an interesting moment in the court, and the addition of the two new members since a number of these decisions have come forward has provided just some very fascinating dynamics, and so it's good to see.
It has, Roberts relied on precedent in the Louisiana case, and so this is just like the case, I think it was out of Texas, that we settled a couple of years ago. It's almost identical, even though in that one he voted the other way.
Correct, but he didn't view that there was enough there to overturn the precedent.
Right, exactly.
So that's why I'm saying some of this becomes a little bit technical, as the Louisiana case that I mentioned, but some of it also becomes, you know, good responsible jurisprudence in the sense that, the one we discussed on religious liberty, that, you know, at a certain point, it's, you know, I mean, we're obviously prejudiced on it, but at a certain point, it's common sense. I mean, if you're going to offer this, then why are you discriminating against these people?
Right.
Right. And it doesn't, you know, if you have no rational basis to discriminate, you know, that, you know, is there, then why would you do that? So, you know, I find that interesting. But as I say, I think we're still in for some challenging times ahead. I think the court's looking at right now at the Fair Employment Act,
and
how far that extends within the religious spectrum, and that certainly implicates the Hosanna-Tabor case that you mentioned earlier. It's sort of as I was sharing with Bishop Soto, that becomes, you know, an interesting dilemma to see how the court will move forward on that. Will they just use their precedents in Hosanna-Tabor and extend it in a blanket way to the Fair Employment Act, or will they set expectations that the religious community define the ministerial exemption more specifically, or will they define it, or, you know, who knows? In the current cultural milieu, we can expect pushback.
We should explain that a little bit more. If a Catholic school or a church, doesn't have to be Catholic, the Montana case wasn't a Catholic school either.
Correct.
That if the person is like a teacher and is under the auspices of the church, and you know, you're supposed to be promoting church teaching, and in fact, it's in your contract usually, that there's a ministerial exception which would go against normal, labor law, if you will.
That's correct.
That if somebody in a
proposal, yes.
Right. Somebody in a public school would have a different case than someone in a Catholic school or even a religious school.
Correct. And the two cases that have before the Supreme Court have to do with Catholic schools, whereas the other ones you mentioned did not have to do with Catholic schools, but others. But the implications are the same for all religious schools, and the other two, you know, were the people claimed a violation of the Fair Employment Act relative to age discrimination and health care, and the schools indicated that they did not agree that that was the reason that people were let go, but nevertheless, they felt that they were claiming the ministerial exemption because they taught religion in their schools. And one would hope that the court can see it in the direction that, that someone who chooses to teach in a religious school, one of our schools, a Catholic school, would understand that they are representing the church.
Sure.
So particularly when they teach religion, and perhaps, as we have come to expect in the ministerial exemption, that their behaviors, their public behaviors, would also not conflict with the teachings of the church. And my point is that given where the society is on individual rights, we're going to get a lot of pushback on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And yet, you know, not dealing with religious issues, but you'll see people taking to Facebook or Twitter or a million other things and saying something that their employer, not a religious employer, finds outrageous, they lose their jobs.
Yep.
And nobody goes, oh, well, poor Bill. And usually somebody will say, well, freedom of speech. And then, well, yeah, freedom of speech, but speech has consequences.
Yeah, and politically correct begins to triumph from other rights.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're that's an interesting observation, Bob. I hadn't thought about that one.
Yeah.
It's sort of on the other side of the shoe too. So,
it is. Yeah.
Yeah, but we're struggling with it, and you know the other issue that Bishop Soto and I were discussing was the whole question of parents' rights and religious freedom in relative to. Mm-hmm. Sex education in schools,
right.
And you know that's obviously a very neuralgic issue right now, and one that you know will challenge us as parents that are faithful to engage responsibly, respectfully, and responsibly. But you know the state operates in loco parentis, so
yeah.
How do we make our wishes known, and how do we work with the processes set up, and how do we respect the diversity of the public schools?
Yeah, indeed. And I should note for our listeners, Ned, you didn't just have an off-the-record conversation with the bishop. It's available at scd.org on the diocesan website.
That's correct. Thank you, Bob, for reminding me about that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Sometimes I forget that what passed for my professional conversations with the bishop, the ones that I did. So anyway, but yeah, thank you.
People can tune into that and hear it directly. But,
yeah, well, and it's just an interesting time for us as people of faith, and you know, I guess I would maybe it doesn't fall into religious liberty, but it or religious freedom, but I think it falls into our responsibility as faithful Catholics, particularly faithful Catholics. I think, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, we have, a private faith, yes, that, you know, we have a relationship with the Lord, and you know, we want to foster that, and we want to live that as faithfully as we can, as we live in, as representatives of Christ in the world. And at the same time, we have a very public theology. We have a very public expression of that faith, which are not separable. They're together for those of us as Catholics. We're both private and public people of faith and expected to be so, and our faith invites us to be the presence of Christ in the world, and therefore, you know, we are publicly in the world, and so it's an interesting moment for us to reflect on, as the bishops have done in the midst of this COVID and environment here, how do we respect the rights of the individual yet protect each other and care for the common good as we look at this question of racism and the disruption, how do we foster again, you know, the civil dialogue and the responsible transition to end racism, et cetera, you know, as we move forward. And I think as Catholics, we have a responsibility to move beyond the ideological positions and to move beyond the partisan positions into the presence of the Spirit, inviting conversation, mm-hmm. inviting dialogue, inviting people to work together on solutions.
Yeah, that is so well said. And you know, it's frustrating sometimes that in the political realm, people try to talk about the Catholic vote or the, you know, mm-hmm. you should be voting this way, or you should be voting for this person. And when indeed we don't fit very neatly into any current major political party.
No, and we shouldn't, we shouldn't fit comfortably anywhere. I mean, we will choose to fit somewhere more than likely, but we shouldn't fit comfortably anywhere.
Right.
And regardless of which, you know, political party we're with, we have a responsibility to seek the truth and to pursue the truth. And that will make us somewhat, and in light of my earlier comments, I don't mean this in any violent way, but that will make us somewhat disruptive because mm-hmm. we have to constantly ask a question, you know, and the clear ones that we are, you know about certainly have to do with the Democrats and abortion, and
right.
you can deal with the Republicans and immigration,
right.
you know,
right.
it's like, you know, so pick a, you know, but, you know, we cannot settle in and just say we are this and only this. We are, you know, we are the body of Christ in the world, and we have to constantly be seeking to bring about that the kingdom he invited.
Yeah, you know, people say, well, you agree with me here. You must agree with me on X, Y, and Z. And you go, well, no, actually, I only agree there. And yeah. And those two are the two obvious ones. And,
right. And I think a challenge I've experienced, and you may have yourself, and I think most Catholics who take their faith seriously experience, is the sort of, what would I say, the temptation to fall into just going along
mm-hmm.
and not raising the concern and not saying to, you know, friends, family sometimes, you know, others in the public arena, you know, to, you know, the people in the same party or whatever, just saying, well, but, you know, hold it. Let's not just knee-jerk this. Let's
right.
think about what are we, who do we care about and why? And what is that vision of the human person and the good society we're striving towards? Or is it just about making me feel good?
Right.
Or is it just about making this group of people feel good? And so, you know, I think it's, and, you know, I'm probably overgeneralizing, but, you know, but it's a genuine call, and it's going to highlight itself again for us in the November elections.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, we as Catholics agree that life is sacred from conception to natural death, mm-hmm. but along that continuum, there's a whole bunch of things happening. There's, you know, are you in favor or against early childhood education? Are you in favor or against helping people if they want to attend a private school or a religious school? Are you in favor or not of in the military when somebody turns 18 and can be in the military? Are you what about unemployment? What about fair employment? What about economic justice? And all through this continuum, and then when we get into the senior years, how do we treat our seniors? And then end-of-life care on all the way through, and none of those fit just one philosophy, just one, because there's so many different situations that people find themselves in.
Very, very true. And you know, and you can add the environment and other, you know, complex issues that,
yeah.
Create polarization. And, you know, sadly, you know, we do have a rather polarized society right now. And again, you know, I reiterate the call for us to do some prayer and reflection and action driven by the Spirit to find out how do we do both personally and collectively what we need to do to lessen that polarization, to seek that civility, to seek that common good, to seek that vision of a good society. And again, I'm not giving any specifics, but I think it's a general stance and a general presence. And we can take heart in the fact that, you know, as we celebrated a few weeks ago at Pentecost, you know, mm-hmm. the Spirit is with us. And Jesus left the Spirit to inform us and to invite us. And if we prayerfully and respectfully, you know, engage the issue, understand the issue, understand what our faith says about that particular issue, or at least the principles behind that issue, then we turn in prayer and, you know, then we respond. And we do so in a civil and respectful way. And, you know, that's called forming a conscience and operating from a formed conscience and participating in a faithful way in the citizenship.
And one thing that's wonderful, at least for me, about being Catholic is the church is not, they're not going to tell us who to vote for, but they're not shy about laying out, and you know, as former executive director of the Catholic Conference here and in Washington State, about, you know, giving very succinct, strong opinions about myriad issues of the day and what Catholic teaching says about them.
Correct. In the interpretation of the bishops who are mm-hmm. charged with helping us understand that interpretation. It doesn't mean we're necessarily always going to agree, but it means we have to take it seriously.
Yeah.
And we have to engage it. and, you know, and if you're not going to agree, you better have a really good reason, you know, because...
As Antonin Scalia said about the death penalty, he said, I've read what the bishops had to say about it, and I disagree.
Yep.
That's all he said.
You know? He took it seriously.
But he did take it seriously. And he, like you, has a son who's a priest.
And that's true. Yep, that's true. Yeah, so it's, you know, it's a wonderful moment. And I think, you know, this 4th of July weekend, this 4th of July celebration that goes on for a week or more is a beautiful time, you know, for us as people of faith, as Catholic people of faith, to reflect on our responsibility and our response. You know, what are we responsible for and what are we going to do?
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. I should hasten to add that I've read what the bishops say about the death penalty as well, and I happen to agree.
Likewise. Well, we've discussed that one, and we're on the same page on that one.
Yeah. But it is, you know, and there are times when I say, you know, Lord, I'm struggling with this issue, and I need your help here, you know, because...
Beautiful. And that's what we do.
Yeah.
Turn to the Spirit, turn to God in prayer.
Yeah. Yeah,
guide me, and then trust that, you know, the answer you get by understanding the issue to the best of your ability, by understanding the Catholic perspective on that to the best of your ability, and then seeking guidance. That's, again, how we form our conscience.
Amen. Ned, it is always so good to talk with you.
Well, likewise. You know, we just get sort of rattling on, don't we?
We do. I can't wait to watch you with the bishop. And I'm sure our paths are going to cross again soon. I hope that some of these events that we always see you at, the Red Mass and the dinner afterwards, the Thomas More, and all these other events, which... Life Center events. I just found out today that the Bishop Gallegos maternity home dinner, which I just love, is not going to take place this September.
I know so many things, but opportunities for us to find ways to be generous.
Yeah, indeed, and but all those places, you know, when they might not have their dinner, but they're going to have their virtual dinner, and we can still participate. The Life Center, as far as I know, their event in November is still on. We'll see, and these things take so much planning that you can't push the date too close and then cancel. So.
As we're finding out in so many parishes and so many different situations that, you know, we have to figure out what is God inviting us to understand and know about ourselves individually and collectively in this moment.
Indeed. Well, we'll look forward to the next time we can get together. And till then, stay well, and God bless you and your family. And I hope
to you and yours, and look forward to another time in the near future.
Very good. Thanks so much, Ned.
God bless.
God bless you, too. That's Ned DeLessi, the former executive director of the California Catholic Conference, and was also the director of the Catholic Conference up in the state of Washington.
I wanted to announce something I forgot. My wife's pregnant.
Well,
I'm having a baby, another baby. Well, I'm not having it. She's having the baby.
No.
I'm standing by while she's pregnant.
I mean, it's you know, you could be playing golf while she's having a baby. But
I could be.
But
I'll be engaged, as usual.
It is the miracle of life.
Yeah.
You both are having a baby. There's no way around that.
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, it's definitely going to be my responsibility forever, so it's mine.
It's genetically, it's half you.
Exactly.
Which is kind of scary.
It is. That's the part, that my wife is not wild about. She's already seen what happens.
Although, there are some families where you go, every single kid, there's like stair steps, you know?
Yeah.
Every single kid looks like the mom, or every single kid looks like the dad.
Right.
And you go, how did that happen? I thought it was a 50-50 deal.
Yeah, it's weird. It is weird. My daughter...
well, that's exciting.
Thank you. My daughter's very excited. At 4 years old, we told the two kids together. My son at 7, not super excited about it. But then I explained, like, hey, we're going to get to do fun stuff with the baby and this and that. And he's warming up to the idea. My daughter instantly said, I want it to sleep in my room. I want to feed it, and I'll be very gentle with it, which would be a first for my daughter, because being gentle is not necessarily her forte. Yeah. But yeah, so that was, I was going to tell you yesterday and I forgot. And I wanted to tell you, because it was one of those things where we've known for a while, but we haven't said anything yet because of just, you know, the time frame. Yeah. You kind of want to wait. And then it just slipped my mind when we were talking yesterday. And then it was like one of those things I completely forgot. So I wanted to tell you.
Gift from God.
Yes, absolutely. I can't wait. It's going to be fun.
We now have a trinity of children.
We are outnumbered is another way to put it. Yes,
that's true. And as they get ambulatory, they're faster than you are, too.
I know. I just really hope my son stays on my side.
And by the time mine turned 8, they were all smarter than I was.
Oh, yeah. So. My daughter has, I mean, I don't know how she does it. I know I'm being manipulated. Yeah. I know that it's happening,
yeah.
But then, and it's great because she's good at manipulation, but then also she's really good at the I don't know how else to put it, so the blunt force trauma way of making things happen the way she wants it to happen. Yeah. Because at night when I put her to bed, I give her a hug and kiss, and she'll like give me a hug and she'll go, stay with me for a while, daddy. And I'm like, no, honey, you're gonna go to bed. She'll go, stay, please. I'm like, no. And then she grabs me super tight and goes, stay with me, daddy. And I'm like, oh my gosh. Okay.
Well, you know, as my wife explained to me one time I don't know, our 6 or 7 year old was, you know, not having a tantrum, but wanted something, or, you know, wasn't getting their way or whatever. And she said, look, compare your situation to theirs. They don't have a dime. They do not have a dime.
Right.
Anything in that store, I want this little toy or this candy bar or whatever it is, this Slurpee. They can't do it. They cannot independently go up and buy it. They can't drive the car.
Yeah.
They can't leave the house without permission.
That's a good point.
They can't walk into a restaurant and order something. They can't do anything without permission. It's kind of, and I thought, okay, all right, I'll cut them a little slack.
I sympathize because before I started my career, that's sort of my wife and I's dynamic.
Yeah,
we go places, and I'm like, "Hey, honey, is there any way I can get a soda?" So yeah, no, I get that. Yeah, no, it's true. It's funny how you think one thing is going to be the way it is, and it never is. And it's funny because you think, okay, I had a kid, I got it figured out, and then I had my daughter, and it was like, I know nothing.
There's no book.
And now it's like I got arrogant for half a second and thought, boy or girl, it doesn't matter. I got one of each. I'll be good to go. And then I realized, no, wait. I've never had a third kid, though. So now I have no idea what's going to happen.
I had a son first, and then 4 daughters, and then a son.
Yep.
Bookend.
Bookends with the boys.
Bookends.
Yeah.
You know, and the one thing that somebody gave it to my wife, like at a shower party, a shower event, a shower.
A shower.
It's not a shower party. It's a shower.
Yeah.
It was day by day of the pregnancy.
Oh, right.
What's happening with your child? And she didn't want to cheat. This is day 14. Your child is already smarter than you are. You know, this is day 15. Their finger is starting to, you know, all these things. And that's the, boy, you get to like day 19. I said, the heart is beating. And you go, what?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Right.
And every day it was like, oh, what's happening today?
Right.
And it was fabulous. So there's everything up to the moment of birth.
I think
and
I remember looking at something
no
like that.
No guidelines, no manual, no nothing.
And every day would tell you, like, it would compare the size of your baby to something.
Yeah.
Like, today's the size of a garbanzo bean. Exactly. Today is the size of, and it would be like, it started becoming like, it was like weird comparisons. Like, it's now the size of a full-grown, like, cockroach. And you're like, okay, like, there's no other animal you could compare it to.
Exactly.
Or, you know, now it's like the size of a baby raccoon. It's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, no, it's...
But yeah, so pretty exciting. The only bummer has been with everything going on medically, I didn't get to go hear the heartbeat.
Yeah.
I had to stay out. And so my wife filmed it and I got to watch the video of it. And I don't know if I'm going to get to go to the 20-week one or 22, whatever it is, when you actually get the actual ultrasound.
Right.
I don't know if I'm going to get to go to that. And if, I mean, if this whole thing continues into the actual birthday, I know I get to be there for that, but nobody else, obviously. Right. But still, I mean, obviously.
Do you have a due date?
It's mid-January. So mid, which with my kids being what they are, it'll be late. So, and my birthday's early February. So I assume that's just sort of one more thing, you know, as a dad, as your independence gets stripped away from you as a father, it's yeah. like, just take my birthday.
Yeah.
So, you know, but yeah, no, so it's one of those things. I think, it should be mid January, late January. So that'll be fun.
Good.
Yeah. First Jesus' birthday?
Yeah.
Then my child's birthday.
That's right.
Yeah. So we get to separate everybody's birthdays.
Well, congratulations.
That's Thank you, sir.
Exciting news. Very, very exciting news. So, you know, so much happening. We have virtual Camp Pendola is going to take place this summer. Go to pendola.org. It's starting in just a week or so, and they're going to have four different sessions. Six days long, week long, if you will. And the first one starts on July the 12th and runs through the 17th, Fun in the Sun. Session two, July 19th to the 24th. I know that sounds like 5 days. It's actually six. 19th to the 24th, Christmas in July. July 26th to 31 is Mission Possible. And the final session, session four, August 2nd to the 7th, Weird Science. For campers 6 to 17 years old, yeah, it's all going to be at home. Three different times during the day there will be camp activity, including in the evenings. It's $100 per camper. Go to pendola.org to register or 916-733-0135 or contact Jen Campbell at jcampbell@scd.org. We'll take a break. Back with more on the Bishop's Hour right after this. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the St. Vincent de Paul Society. Drop by and shop at their thrift store, a beautiful, beautiful thrift store at 2275 Watt Avenue. Open Mondays through Saturdays from 10 to 8 and Sundays from 11 to 6. They also accept donations at the store, donations of furniture, appliances, clothing, books, everyday household items. Your donations help to fund the many projects of the St. Vincent de Paul Society throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Do such wonderful, wonderful work, and the thrift store is one of the ways they raise the funds to help people throughout the diocese, and also many of their clients are able to access the thrift store for items that they need. You can give them a call. They will come pick it up as well, but you can give them a call. They're at 916-972-1212. And remember, again, the thrift store is open 7 days a week at 2275 Watt Avenue right here in Sacramento. Well, Bishop Soto refers to Christ the King Retreat Center as the jewel of the diocese, and indeed it is. What a beautiful oasis it is. It's located in Citrus Heights, right in the hustle and bustle of the city, and you feel like you're getting away from it all when you turn off the main road and just come into Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center. Christ the King has served Northern California and the Diocese of Sacramento for over 60 years through parish weekend retreats, individual spiritual direction, and a variety of other programs. For information on all the programs that they offer, including residential programs, give them a call. They're at 916-725-4720, or you can visit them at 6520 Van Maren Lane in Citrus Heights. And we certainly thank the St. Vincent de Paul Society and Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center for their fine and longstanding support of the Bishop's Hour.
Hi, I'm John McGinnis, retired sheriff of Sacramento County, and you're listening to the Bishop's Hour with Bob Dunning.
Thank you, Sheriff. I appreciate you taking the time to do that. I remember a few years ago we had the sheriff in here with but it had been some you know unrest here in Sacramento, and we had the sheriff in here to with members of the community to pray the rosary for peace in our community. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court just the other day, in a 5-4 ruling, the Supreme Court said the exclusion of religious schools in Montana's state scholarship aid program violated the federal Constitution. In the majority opinion written by Chief Justice John Roberts, the court ruled that if a state offers financial assistance to private schools, it has to allow religious schools to also take part. So basically what this ruling said, Montana had a program which aided schools in some way, I think, with tax credits, and aided private schools to help the parents that decide to send their kids to private schools to, I mean, it's a release of a burden on public schools of a degree. And I know there people will have varied opinions on this decision and on the whole issue of state aid to private schools. But the Montana was providing some aid to the parents who chose to send their children to private schools, not necessarily religious private schools. And the Montana Supreme Court overturned that and said it was a violation of the Blaine Amendments, which forbid public money going to Catholic or religious schools, of which many would have been Catholic schools. That was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court overruled the Montana Supreme Court, which is a very interesting decision, and will have far-reaching throughout the country. Justice Roberts said the decision by the Montana Supreme Court to invalidate the school scholarship program because it would provide funding to both religious schools and secular schools, quote, bars religious schools from public benefits solely because of the religious character of the schools. That's the crux of the decision. What Justice Roberts is saying is if it was just a private school, of which there are many private schools that are not religious based, if that private school was allowed to have state money, but another private school was not allowed to have state money because it was religious, that would be discriminating against religion. You know, that it's basically what the Constitution says is you can't favor religion. You can't say, oh, we're going to give money. Let's say the Montana law, instead of saying that the money was going to private schools, it was going only to religious schools or only to Catholic schools. Any other private school wasn't eligible for it. That would be discrimination in favor of religion. That would also, presumably, these same justices, you don't know, but presumably the same justices, if they were consistent, would say that would be a violation as well. The crux of this was this money was being made available to private schools, but it was being kept from religious private schools. All religious schools are private. Religious private schools, strictly because they were religious, and so they couldn't participate in it. Which is, and there've been other cases, not about that specifically, but where some aid went to private schools, and I remember a case that had to do with state funds, and I don't remember the state, a few years ago, state funds to which was helping school playgrounds repave the playgrounds or put wood chips down instead of pavement, that kind of thing, to make them safer. And the same kind of issue came up where private schools were eligible for the funds to redo their playgrounds, and public schools were eligible for the funds to redo their playgrounds and make them safer. But religious schools weren't allowed to have the funds to make their playgrounds safer because they were religious schools. And it was one of the justices that we weren't talking about teaching religion here. We were talking about preventing skinned knees, you know. So it's similar to that. If you're going to do something for private schools, well, you got to do it for all the private schools or for none of the private schools. Otherwise, you're discriminating. So that's the crux of this decision. But it was a 5-4 decision. Justice Roberts said the provision also bars parents who wish to send their children to religious school from those same benefits, again, solely because of the religious character of the school. Sister Dale McDonald, a sister of the Presentation of the Blessed Virgin Mary, who is the director of public policy and Educational Research for the National Catholic Educational Association, said she was happy with the decision, mainly because, quote, it puts faith-based organizations on a level playing field to be able to also take part in other opportunities. And to say, and for the court to say these scholarship programs have to be inclusive is a big victory, she told Catholic News Service. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops said the court, quote, rightly ruled that the U.S. Constitution does not permit states to discriminate against religion. This decision means that religious persons and organizations can, like everyone else, participate in government programs that are open to all. The statement from Archbishop Thomas G. Wentzke of Miami, who is chairman of the USCCB's Committee for Religious Liberty, and Bishop Michael Barber of Oakland, who is chairman of the USCCB's Committee on Catholic Education, also said the decision was good news, not only for people of faith, but for our country. This is a quote from their statement. A strong civil society needs the full participation of religious institutions, they said. By ensuring the rights of faith-based organizations, freedom to serve, the court is also promoting the common good. Advocates for school choice also praised the decision. Quote, this is from Jeannie Allen, founder and chief executive of the Center for Education Reform. The weight that this monumental decision carries is immense, as it's an extraordinary victory for student achievement, parental control, equality in educational opportunities, and First Amendment rights. The case was Espinoza v. Montana Department of Revenue, which was brought to the court by three Montana mothers who had been sending their children to Stillwater Christian School, not a Catholic school, Stillwater Christian School in Kalispell, which is on the northwestern part of Montana, very near Glacier National Park. And they had been sending their children to Stillwater Christian School in Kalispell with the help of a state scholarship program. The program, created in 2015, was meant to provide $3 million a year for tax credits for individuals and business taxpayers who donated up to $150 to the program. It was helping about 45 students, and just months after it got started, the Montana Department of Revenue issued an administrative rule saying that tax credit donations could only go toward non-religious private schools, explaining the use of tax credits for religious schools violated the state's constitution. The mothers were represented by the Institute for Justice, which is a nonprofit legal advocacy group based in Virginia. In 2015, these mothers sued the state, saying that barring religious schools from the scholarship program violated the federal constitution. The trial court agreed with them, but the Montana Supreme Court reversed this decision. The court based its decision on the state constitution's ban on funding religious organizations, which is called the Blaine Amendment. 37 states have Blaine Amendments, which prohibit spending public funds on religious education. They go back to the 19th century. Our name for Representative James Blaine of Maine, who tried unsuccessfully in 1865 to have the U.S. Constitution prohibit the use of public funds for sectarian schools. Adam Unikowski, Montana's attorney, argued that the state's revised constitution in 1972 does not have any evidence whatsoever of anti-religious bigotry. However, the USCCB's June 30 statement said the court dealt a blow to the odious legacy of anti-Catholicism in America, stressing that the Blaine Amendments in the states were the product of nativism and bigotry, and were never meant to ensure government neutrality toward religion, but were expressions of hostility toward the Catholic Church. And if you don't believe that, just go back less than 100 years in the 1900s, 1921, I believe, mid-1920s, when the state of Oregon banned Catholic schools, legally banned illegally eventually, as it turned out. The Supreme Court overruled it, but actually banned Catholic schools, the state of Oregon. So if you don't believe there was a lot of anti-Catholicism out there in America's history, go back and read. There's a lot we need to go back and read in the history of this country. And anti-Catholicism was one of those things that was there, and that we're talking about it because of this case dealing with religious schools. A group of Montana Catholic school parents submitted a friend of the court brief stressing that state Blaine amendment should be declared unconstitutional once and for all. The USCCB also filed a friend of the court brief along with several other religious groups in support of the plaintiffs, which said families that use private schools should not suffer government discrimination because their choice of school is religious. Before the case was argued, Richard Garnett, who is the director, he's a professor at the University of Notre Dame, and he's director of the University of Notre Dame's program on church, state, and society, said it could have major implications for education reform debates and policies, and it could, quote, and it, quote, could remove or at least reduce one of the legal barriers to choice-based reforms like scholarship programs and tax credits for low-income families. Very, very interesting, and one of those rulings that will be very much stated as a landmark ruling among the many, many landmark rulings that the Supreme Court issues. Again, it was a 5-4 decision. We'd like to thank all the wonderful people and organizations, businesses in town, and throughout the Diocese of Sacramento who have provided underwriting for the Bishop's Hour, some in the last few years, some have been with us for a very long time. If you would like to be an underwriter for the Bishop's Radio Hour, it's a wonderful opportunity to support this mission and also to support the diocese and also to get some recognition for your organization or for your business. The easiest way to do this is to give us a shout, send us an email, radio@scd.org, and we can give you all the details about helping to underwrite the Bishop's Radio Hour. Again, that's radio@scd.org.
Empty hands held high, such small sacrifice. Not joined with my life, I sing in vain tonight. May the words I